And I said, okay. So I actually had to sit down and I asked myself the question, what have my teachers done in my life so far that I have actually liked? And I put it on one side. Then on the other side, I said, what have my teachers done that perhaps I didn't enjoy it as much? I put it on the other side, things to do and things not to do. And then that was almost 36 years ago. And over that time, that list has kept expanding.
This is the Indianness Podcast, stories of success from leaders and change makers of Indian origin. Why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together, because every story is unique. I'm very excited to have Dr. Ravi Pense with us today. He's the Vice President and Chief Information Officer for the University of Michigan. And prior to that, he was in similar roles at Brown and Wichita State University. He's also a professor in electrical engineering and computer science, and was recently appointed as a special advisor for India to the president of the university. I invited him on this show as I'm fascinated by his journey at some of the largest universities in the world. Besides also, he is the chief information officer of the national champions of college football, the University of Michigan. Welcome, Ravi. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Sanjay, it's a pleasure and honor to be with you on this podcast, and I'm truly humbled by your invitation. Considering all the amazing speakers that you've had, I'm not sure I belong here, but I'm happy to be here.
Well, you're as amazing as all of them, and we're really looking forward to this conversation, and so are our listeners. Ravi, this podcast, Indianness, is really about chronicling the journey, but within the journey, figuring out what are the lessons learned, inflection points, because this is also about others who are listening, who want to figure out as they are on their journey coming up, what can they learn from you? Let us take a walk to your journey and take it right to the beginning. So tell our listeners, where were you born, and tell us about some of the key influencers, whether it's you tell us about your parents or if there were grandparents and siblings. Just walk us through that, Ravi.
And happy to, and thank you for the opportunity to kind of reflect back and go back in that journey, because sometimes life gets so busy that we never take time to reflect. So this is a great opportunity to do that. So thank you. So I was born in Hyderabad, then Andhra Pradesh, state of Andhra Pradesh. Now it's called Telangana, as you probably know. And I had two sisters, and I was the youngest of the three. And the reason I say I had two sisters is my elder sister later in life passed away way too early, in my opinion. She was like a second mother to me and always took care of me along with my mom. And my father was an engineer himself, but had that entrepreneurial spirit. And so he was into doing his own business. My mother was a teacher in high school. And so I grew up in a family like that. And as a youngster, because my father was in business, he had a lot of struggles early on. It was not an easy path, especially at my young age. And there are a couple of times, and these are stories difficult to share, but I'm happy to share them, were quite difficult. I remember an instance, and this is where I cannot believe how strong my mother was. I remember going with her to a local grocery store. In India, you remember, you call them neighborhood Kirana stores, so to speak. And this is a grocery store we were probably frequenting even before I was born for many years. So we were regular customers, but we must have been behind on payments. So I remember my mom buying like a couple of pounds of rice. And as she was leaving, he said he wanted her to pay up and she didn't have money. And he said, well, if you don't have money, I don't have rice to give you. And she had to put that rice back. And then she came out. And I was not old enough to understand what exactly happened or why we didn't get the rice, but I knew something was very wrong. And that kind of influenced me in a way to think very carefully about the resources one has. And really think in terms of the kind of sacrifices that parents do when they raise you, which was very special to us, because I don't remember myself or my sisters ever going hungry. And I don't know how my mom did it. I don't know how my dad did it, but they somehow managed to keep us well fed while they probably went many nights hungry. But I just don't know that. And I always think back to that time of the sacrifices our parents make, our grandparents make to raise us. So everything I'm today, I owe it to my parents, my sisters, my family, in terms of the support that they provide, that fabric of family is so strong in India.
Yeah, it is. It is. A lot to unpack there. Dad was in business. He was an engineer. And obviously, being an entrepreneur, there's always ups and downs. And this was all in Hyderabad?
Yeah, this is in Hyderabad. So he was an electrical engineer, and he took essentially electrical contracts. And so he was a contractor for government. And often what used to happen is to get the contract, you have to invest and money, and then they pay you much later. And he was not the best accountant in the world, let's put it that way. So he struggled. He did a lot of great work, but he struggled with managing money, at least early on. And so there were a lot of struggles during the childhood.
And mom was a teacher, and she was managing, basically she was managing everything else. She was a family maker, etc. And did you feel a sense of insecurity because of the financial stress at that time? Now, looking back, obviously, it's a whole different thing.
Actually, no, because they somehow shielded us from it. We could see the things that were happening. Obviously, our home was really small. It was a rented place, shared bathrooms, but we didn't know any different. At least there was a roof on our head, right? And no running water supplies. You had to go get water from somewhere else. But somehow we were happy, and they managed to keep us that way. And it's kudos to both of them in how they managed it.
And where were you going to school at that time from primary
school? So initially, my kindergarten days, I was in a private school with a lot of friends. So, and then the downtime happened. And so they had to pull me out of that private school and put me in another school. And during my primary education, my father was of the opinion, Marathi is my mother tongue, even though I was born in Hyderabad. So he wanted me to have my primary education in Marathi. So I went to a very small Marathi medium school, actually, not English medium, Marathi medium school.
In Hyderabad?
In Hyderabad, correct. Hyderabad has a sizable population of Maharashtrians. People don't realize it, but back in the old days, several hundred thousand of them. And so there was a Marathi medium school that I went to called Dr. Dowry Primary School. And later on, from sixth grade, I went to Vivek Vardhani High School, which was also run by the same foundation. But that school was in English medium, but again, run by the same society that ran the Dr. Dowry Primary School. So primary education in Marathi, and starting with sixth grade, it switched to English medium.
So when you switched from this private school to this Marathi school, how was that experience? Was that cool, or were you that, hey, why am I going through all this?
Initially, it was difficult because in that private school, they used to treat you really nicely. They would have the lunch laid out for you, and you kind of got the VIP treatment, so to speak. And then in this other school now, you just bring your own tiffin maybe, and then you kind of just sit anywhere on the ground and eat it. So it was a little different. But, you know, one thing I noticed, I experienced myself is, as kids, you're very adaptable. You adapt very quickly. So you just look at other friends, you make new friends, and you just go on. And reaching out and saying hello to somebody, making friends, came easily to me very early.
So because you had to adapt, you didn't have a choice, because you went from this place to that place. Either you adapt or you basically left behind, right?
Agreed. And I was pulled out of the private school because we couldn't afford it anymore. And so obviously that was not explained to me. I didn't know.
At that time. But no. Now looking back, you think that it was economics that actually...
Yeah, it was a financial decision.
Okay. And how are the academics in this new Marathi medium school?
I mean, I think they're fine, because at that age, you don't really think about those things looking back. I mean, we had good, very caring teachers, and it was fine. I still remember some of those teachers. And while nobody's there anymore in that school, each time I visit Hyderabad, I tend to walk by the school just in case. It's still there and it's prospering and all schools. So I do go by there sometimes just for old time's sake.
Yeah, memories, because memories are important, tremendously important. Did you start making any friends at this new school, Ravi?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of friends. Thanks to WhatsApp and technology, I'm in touch with many of them. Especially during COVID, I think a lot of people took a step back and said, I don't know about this thing. And people tried to reach out to each other, and people formed a lot of groups. So I'm in touch with many of them. Some I had not spoken in 30, 40 years.
Oh my
and
gosh.
All reconnected again.
Wow. You made a bunch of friends. The school was close to the house, or was it far?
Yeah, we walked. It was just right across. I had to just cross the street.
Wow. And then in terms of homework and stuff like that, you were doing it on your own. Mom was helping. Dad was helping. Anybody helping you at all? Sister?
No, I think mostly on my own. I was a pretty decent student. And then what was funny about it is I remember in second grade, and this is where my parents are so different, and I think they complimented each other. My dad had an interesting sense of humor. I didn't think it was funny back then. I was in second grade, and in second grade, I had gotten, in India, they rank you in the classes, so I got first rank. And so I proudly brought my progress report home and showed it to my father. So he looked at it once and then said, "You know what this means, right?" I said, "No, what does this mean?" He said, "Either you're smart or the rest of your classmates are incredibly dumb." That was what my father said. So I want to tell you a story about this. So I always remembered it. So fast forward to engineering, and when I had gotten into the first class with distinction, when he said congratulations to me, I jokingly said, "Dad, now you remember what you said when I was in second grade. This means either I'm smart or my classmates are incredibly dumb." He said, "Oh, I can't believe you still remember it." But I did. I mean, there are these some things that you can never forget. The same father, by the way, in second grade, when we didn't have any resources to celebrate my first rank, he actually bought me an entire cricket set, the wickets and the bat and the pads and so on. So I could play with I was the only kid in that very poor neighborhood with a cricket set at that time. He loved me, I think, beyond imagination, but he also had this different sense of humor.
That sense of humor is very important.
Either you can call it humor or keeping you grounded, I guess.
Yeah, keeping you grounded too, which is also sometimes important. And then as the time was going by, you said then you switched to an English medium school?
Yeah.
You switch to English?
No, I didn't. I mean, the Dr. Dowry School, the primary school was only till fifth grade. And after sixth, you go to a different school. Either I could have continued in a Marathi medium school, but my father really was interested in having my primary education in Marathi so I could learn to read and write Marathi. That was his emphasis. And then from sixth grade, I went to Vivekvardhini High School, which is part of the same education society, but the instruction is in English. But candidly, pretty much every teacher in that school was also Marathi. And so you still talk to them in Marathi, and then you try to transition.
Transition. Yeah, we call it Hinglish. I don't know what it is for Marathi and English. So it's something like that. How was that experience, Ravi?
I think it was good because obviously many friends from Dr. Dowry Primary School went to Vivekvardhini, took the same path. So there were several common friends. And then you, of course, made new friends. This school was a lot farther, almost, I would say, a couple of miles. So we had to obviously walk to the school, which was fine. So you just started a little early and you went. And you know how it is in India, even though you're young, they let you walk on the street, on the sidewalks, and you just walk. And so we would walk to the school, and weather is not a huge issue in India. And so we walk, and that used to be an enjoyable time too. A friend just walking and making new friends and going together, coming back from school. So it was fun. And I enjoyed my time there.
And made any different friends or the same set of friends there?
Generally same set of friends, but then obviously you made new friends along the way, right? And one interesting thing that happened, which frankly helped me make new friends, this was around eighth grade, is I used to love playing cricket. You heard about the cricket set, right? And one day while playing cricket, and this was before you wore helmets and so on, I got hit on the face by a glazed ball, as it's called. It's hard. And essentially, my left eye was completely shut for many days, and doctors were worried that I may not be able to see. Thankfully, nothing like that happened. But my mother was very concerned about that. So around that time, I was obviously not allowed to play cricket for a period of time by doctors and others. So I wanted to play something else. So I went to a local sports club called Young Men's Improvement Society, not YMCA. It was called YMIS, Young Men's Improvement Society. And it was meant for men and women, but that's how it was named. And when I went there, I saw this thing called table tennis that people were playing. So I decided to start trying my hand at table tennis. And I realized very quickly that I was actually pretty good at it. And so I went to my mother and I said, "I think I want to play table tennis." And the part she was happy about, she never told me this, was the fact that there was less chances of getting hurt. And so she immediately said, "Let's buy you a new racket," even though we didn't have a lot of money. Back in those days, she spent actually quite a bit of her savings resources to get me a new table tennis racket. And so I started playing table tennis, and I very quickly became good at it to the point that I started winning tournaments in the city, and actually was later selected to represent state in nationals, junior nationals, and I was a ranked player, a lot of paper headlines and so on. And so my mom's gamble turned out to be okay, and I actually never played cricket again. I just focused on table tennis. And so when you then in school, sometimes teachers recognize you when your name maybe came in the paper or something. And a friend of mine from Dr. Dare's school named Arun Deshpande, he was with me. He was also playing table tennis. So we won a lot of tournaments together. Sometimes he would win, sometimes I would win. Sometimes we both would lose. And that was all okay. But it just brought a different discipline and a different way of thinking about life. And it was a lot of fun. So that was a pivotal change in how I thought about sports.
A lot of points to consider here, and I'll try to see if I can pull them. One is inflection point that you got hit by the ball on your face, obviously pretty painful, but had ramifications. Cricket was out, but table tennis, you found out that you have great hand-eye coordination, and table tennis was something you picked up because of that. Otherwise, you would have probably continued playing cricket, and that opened some new doors. And also, the other thing that a lot of our guests talk about is that sports has many other things that it really teaches you in some ways. Humility, because there are other players always who are going to be better. Team spirit, etc. Tell our listeners what were some of the things you learned through your table tennis. There's obviously you make friends also through that process. You became famous. You were in the newspaper.
I mean, I don't know about famous. There were a lot far more famous people than I was. But to a young kid, having your name come in a newspaper was a big deal. But really, in terms of sports, and since you asked about humility, if you'll allow me, I do want to share a story of my mother who got me thinking about humility very early in life. As I told you, we had a not so great childhood in terms of financial resources. So this was not our backyard or anything like that. It was a community backyard that used to have a mango tree. And this mango tree, when I would come back from school walking, my mother would always say to me, "Could you bring me 2 mangoes? And I would look up to the tree and there was no way I could reach any of those mangoes, which were very little. And I would say to mom, I don't think I can get you mangoes. They're too high. I can't reach them." And this question continued. She would always ask me every few days. I mean, she was a very thoughtful person, just amazing teacher. And one day, summer came and his mangoes bloomed during summer in India. And all of a sudden, I noticed that as the mangoes became bigger and bigger, the tree grew because of the weight of the mangoes. And I could reach a couple of mangoes. So I plucked the 2 mangoes. I ran into the house and I said to her, "Hey, I brought you mangoes. Can we eat?" They were not fully ripened mangoes yet. They were unripened mangoes. In India, we call green mangoes or kairi. And so I brought in mango. Mom, let's just eat. She said, "I thought you couldn't get it. How did you get it?" I said, "I actually don't know." So she took me out back to the tree. And she asked me the same question. "How did you get it?" I said, "Mom, I don't know. They were just there and I plucked it." And she said, "Well, let me explain to you why they were there." I said, "Okay, Mom." She said, "When mango tree started bearing fruit, it wanted us to enjoy the fruits of its labor. And that's why it bowed before us. And because it bowed before us, you could actually enjoy the fruits of its labor. But when you pluck those mangoes, you're actually also helping the mango tree because you're preparing it for the next season to give you even more mangoes. So it's a two-way street." And so she said, "In life, maybe you'll not understand it now, but in life, you have become somebody important. It'll be really, really important for you to bow before the people that you work with so that they can enjoy some of your ideas. And at the same time, you'll be enriched with the ideas that they will share with you." That's what she had told me. Honestly, at that age 7, it made no sense to me at all. And I really did not understand the profound thoughtfulness of what she had shared. But later in life, obviously, that became an important. So going back to table tennis, one of the things our coach used to do is when we would be not playing, no matter how seated you were, how ranked you were, he required every player, men, women, the juniors, I was one of the junior players, to stand before even players who were lesser ranked than you. You have to stand behind them, both one on the forehand side, one on the backhand side. And as a ball is missed, you're supposed to catch that ball and then give it back to them. And that was humility in practice, essentially, because you're standing behind potentially players who should be standing behind you in your own mind. But the idea there was that we never understood that well, was we were focused on not dropping that ball. So that gave us even better hand-eye coordination to keeping your eyes on the ball. Not a piece of the person, but on the ball. And then, so that was one of the real lessons. So 2 lessons in humility, one that way and one this way. We are standing behind. So each time I see tennis matches and I see these ball boys and ball girls, I think about that I used those, but not in a famous sports like tennis, just in table tennis, but standing behind and collecting balls.
Some incredible lessons. I mean, your mom, think about the vision of her at that point. She was teaching you basically a servant leadership kind of thought process. If you really think about it, that's what she was teaching you in many ways. Wow.
No, in fact, here in my current position, all my positions, leadership, I talk about that servant leadership, and I talk about that I'm here to serve my colleagues. And I mean it too, because talk is cheap, but you have to actually then emulate, follow up, and show that you are actually a servant leader. And that's never easy. That's a process. The other thing that I followed in terms of humility and in terms of making connections, and that has helped me a long time, is, and I'll use a Sanskrit phrase if it's okay, Acharya Deva Bhava. Acharya is teacher. Teacher is made in the image of God and should be respected as one would respect God. So I always try to see a teacher in everyone I interact with, where it has been very helpful to me, because once you're in that mode where you see every person you essentially connect with as a teacher, then you're in receiving mode. You're not judging, you're receiving, you're trying to learn something good from them. And then, so that has also helped me keep myself grounded and be thinking about and emulating and trying to do my very best to be that servant leader, to be the person who adds value to other people, as opposed to telling people what to do.
Some great insights. Do you look at, I mean, you teach also, right? Would you say that even your students have the ability to teach you in some, or inform you in some ways?
Well, 100%. In fact, you know, when people talk about, you know, mentors, I've been very fortunate to have lots of mentors. I still do. I'm a work in progress. And among many mentors have been my students. Among many mentors have been my own son, my wife. You learn from each person, right? Each one of them brings an interesting value and perspective in life. I learned how to be happy for others through my son, because I used to see him being so delighted at his friends, even though he may not have gotten something, but his friends did, and he was equally happy. I said, I need to emulate that with my students. I mean, they give you the confidence. You may find this funny, but the way I got into teaching was, this was when I was at Wichita State. I was a graduate student. I didn't really like talking in front of people. I was generally quite shy. I liked my community, where you're in a research lab doing your research. And one fine day, our department chairperson, whose name is Ryan Norris, he came into the lab and he said, Pensei, we had a last minute resignation and I need you to teach a class in digital design, which deals with computer architecture, basic computers. And I said, well, Dr. Norris, I have never taught. I don't think it's a very good idea. And he said, it's about time to start. And then I said, my advisor, Dr. Johnson, will never approve. He said, I've already talked to Johnson and he has approved. And then he walked out. And I was terrified. I said, like, how am I going to teach this class? So the friendliest person in the department that I knew was our department administrative assistant. Her name was Elaine Giles. I went to her and I said, Mrs. Giles, can you tell me how you teach? And she said, she looked at me and said, dear God, you need help. And she said, do you have a book for the class? And I said, no, I don't have a book for the class. So she said, here's a desk copy. So I looked at the book and she said, do you know that stuff? And I said, yeah, I know this stuff. She said, then you will be fine. And so I was really worried. And I called my mother in India. Calls were very expensive that time. It cost almost $4 a minute. And I needed to call her and said, Mom, they have asked me to teach. What do you think I should do? You've been a teacher. And she said, listen, I have never taught in America, so I don't know what you do, but you know, just do your best. You'll be fine. And I said, okay. So I actually had to sit down and I asked myself the question, what have my teachers done in my life so far that I have actually liked? And I put it on one side. Then on the other side, I said, what have my teachers done that perhaps I didn't enjoy it as much? I put it on the other side, things to do and things not to do. And then that was almost 36 years ago. And over that time, that list has kept expanding. Every time I see a speaker, I see a presenter do something that I enjoy, it goes on one side. I see a speaker or presenter do something that they don't enjoy, it goes on the other side. And before every lecture I give, before every class I teach, I pull that list out just to remind myself what not to do. And it has served me well. And going back to that very first class that I taught, it was in an amphitheater type setting. So all the class looks down on you. And I was walking down the class on my first class, my heart was beating so hard. I always say, that the only reason I stayed in that class, my first class, was it did not have an exit door where the chalkboard or whiteboard was. If there was an exit door, I would have walked right out. And I decided to stay in the class because the only way I could walk out was I would have to pass all these students again, and this time looking at me. And so I said, the best thing to do is to be honest. So I told them that, hey, listen, I'm still learning, and this is my first class, but I'm going to do my really very best. And what was interesting there, going back to your question about students being mentors, is they were fine. They took it upon, they appreciated the fact that I was going to work hard. And pretty soon, in a day, second or third class, they started giving me feedback on how wonderful it was. And that positive reinforcement was helpful to me. And so in life, I said, we are very quick to point out what doesn't work as a leader, as a person. Positive reinforcement actually goes a long way. It helped me become the teacher I am today. It helped me become the person I am today. So I took that lesson from my students along the way of providing that positive reinforcement and positive feedback. Just face it, in every situation, there is something positive you can point out to a person. We should, of course, have discussions about things that didn't work, but we don't need to start with it.
Ravi, again, you covered some absolutely brilliant points. So for our listeners, I just want to reemphasize that, and just correct me if I'm wrong. One is, you talked about mentors. Now, you said you learn from students, you learn from your colleagues. You need to have a receptiveness also to be able to do that, right? So that's one of the messages that you have given, is learning from them. And then you also said that you make a list, which I find so fascinating. So that goes to really self-learning. So you are still in a self-learning mode. You don't think that you had some amazing position, so you could say, hey, I know it all, let me just mail it in. But you are going there and listening, watching speakers, and still adding to the plus and minus side what to do, what not to do. So self-learning does not stop no matter at what point you are. That's the other point you are kind of making. I'm afraid you're going to be making that list on me also at some point, but that we will not go there. But then you are talking about transparency. You went to that class, you would have run away if there was an exit sign. But then you are honest with your students. And that honesty and that openness gave you that ability to build that connectivity. Those were three very important points that I made. Did I cover them correctly, Ravi?
You're an amazing interviewer, so congratulations to you. The only other thing I would add is transparency and willing to be vulnerable, where you are sharing with them. Sometimes the culture is you never show people that you are struggling, or never show people that you maybe are concerned about something. And being vulnerable and telling students, hey, I'm very nervous. This is my first class. My heart is beating. And it's okay. It's okay to do that. And it's okay to be honest and direct with people and colleagues. I struggled with imposter syndrome, for example. When I went from Wichita State, which is an amazing institution, great school. I was there for many years, a lot of accolades, a lot of kind people thinking that I was doing a great job. And then I find myself at Brown University, which is another great school, but an Ivy League school. Most of my colleagues there were not from Wichita State. Almost all of them were from either MIT or Harvard or Michigan. You fill in the blanks, right? And there I was from Wichita State. And I was genuinely concerned. I said, did they make a mistake hiring me? Can I actually add value here? I'm not so sure. And the funny part was, the same thing happened when I moved from Brown to Michigan. Brown is a much smaller institution and scale compared to Michigan. And then I was in the same mindset, like, can I handle this? The number of people, the number of reports, the number of challenges that come, the visibility that comes with a position like this. And I was very honest about that too. In fact, prior to my arrival at Michigan, including the interim CIOs, the previous 3 years, they had gone through a total of 4 CIOs because it is a challenging position here. I jokingly used to tell my staff colleagues in my first few months that I was on a month-to-month plan and I was opening one box every month just in case they decided to get rid of me. And someone actually believed me. And then they found out I had actually bought a house. And they said, oh, you bought a house? I said, yeah, I bought it even before I moved, because we didn't want to move twice. So we ended up buying a house. But I was being honest that these things happen in life. It's okay to be concerned. It's okay to have that a little nervousness about opportunities. But, you know, this is where you depend on your colleagues. You see everybody as a teacher around you. You learn from them. You build your team. You work with people around. And so that's the other thing I would share, that along the journey, and I'm still absolutely work in progress. So you have to learn every single day, because otherwise life gets boring. What's there to life if you're not learning?
Ravi, coming to that imposter syndrome that you talked about, which is very important because a lot of us in life go through, whether it's in a social situation, you're going to Davos or something like that, and you find your first time, et cetera. How did you deal with that? Because Wichita State, great institution, but Brown has an elitist kind of feeling. How did you deal with that? I mean, the first day, the second day, et cetera, et cetera.
You learn to be honest about your feelings with your colleagues that you can be honest with. And then you build a team around you, right? So I was very honest as I dealt with it. Frankly, when I first arrived at Brown, Wichita State is not a highly selective institution, but a great institution. So there, for example, I knew that when we did the student success initiatives using technology, I was actually making a difference. When I would win this large research grant and we were able to fund a lot of graduate students, I knew I was making a difference. And then I was at Brown where, while not unlimited resources, Brown had plenty of resources. So resource was not an issue. Brown is highly selective. So when you're bringing in students, admitting 5 to 8% of the students, these are some of the best students in the world. So student success may not have been necessarily an issue that. So I struggled my first year saying, am I at the right institution? Am I making a difference here? And then I realized even at Brown, as amazing institution as it is, there are many students because of generosity of Brown who are first-generation college students. So they need a mentor. They need a support system around them. Or students from historically underrepresented groups. Sometimes they're from one-family households. They need a mentor. They need help. So I was able to find that place and work with them. And I used to talk to them about imposter syndrome. I used to talk to them about my challenges in life. Because face it, in our institutions, mental health and wellness has become a huge challenge at all institutions. And is to openly talk to them about my failures. Because one of the things that all of these institutions happens is when you are a high-performing student in high schools and other places, you have rarely failed at anything. Then you come to an institution like Brown or Michigan, you're a high-performing student, but all of a sudden, there are 5,000 like you. And not everybody is going to get, you know, what they're aspiring every exam and so on. So a little bit of struggle can be challenging. And then they see their faculty members and they read their bios. And I was not like that, but everybody is a National Academy member or something else, has won awards, and everybody looks like, yeah, exactly. Everybody looks like super men and super women. And so they feel like, well, that's how the world is. And so we, many faculty members came together and we together would talk, not artificially, but whenever there was an opportunity about some of our challenges and some of our failures, including in my case, the imposter syndrome I felt, because we need to be honest with our young people that we have an opportunity to interact with. It's really important.
But then, Ravi, I mean, you talked about a very important thing that we should be able to talk about our failures. That is not easy, right? It's very easy to talk about our successes. How many of us can do that? But what you're saying is that's very important to do that. How do you get to that point where you are comfortable talking about your failure?
I mean, again, it's easily said than done. It's not easy for everyone. So first, you have to be comfortable in your own skin, if I may say that. You have to be comfortable with who you are. And once you are, then you're able to, I think, frankly, talk about it. Candidly, maybe the way I talk about today, I was not this way 20 years ago. Maybe because I was maybe not secure, the feeling of security. So I have evolved over a time period. I've seen others take this courageous step and watching others have learned from them. When people say, I had a problem or I attended, I'll give you an example. Our current president, President Santa Ono, he has been very open about when he was a student, how he attended suicide, for example. And which is not, it was not easy for him to do that, right? Because he's the president of University of Michigan. Before that, he was president of other great institutions. And you would think, well, I'm sure this guy has it together. But he was very open about that. And I've known other courageous people who have talked about this. And so you learn from them by watching them, right? I mean, compared to that, you feeling like an imposter syndrome, maybe nothing. And so you realize that in the grand scheme of things, it's okay to share these things. Some people will judge you, and that's okay. That's their prerogative. But there'll be others, even if you can help one person by your conversation or two people, then you have moved the needle. You have made a positive difference to someone else.
Wow, that's a very good point. Very good point. Ravi, just to take you back again, we talked about one inflection point that you had because of the whole cricket ball hitting you and you got into table tennis. As you were going along, then from high school, as you moved along, can you think of other inflection point that happened that is significant?
Coming to United States, for example.
Okay. How did you think about that? I mean, was that something? You were not from a very affluent family.
So candidly, by the time I was in engineering, my father was doing very well in his business, much better than my childhood. And then so we would have been able to at least get a loan from the bank. So that was not, so getting a loan was not an issue. So I would say we were kind of lower middle class family by then, not as poor as we used to be. So we're in much, we just still didn't own a home, but we were in much better shape than we used to be. So it was not a financial decision. I just wasn't certain because frankly, I was very close to my parents, especially my mother. And I was the youngest of the three. By then, my sisters were already married. And so I was with my mom and dad, and especially my mom. And so leaving her was a difficult choice for me. And so I wasn't sure. But what happened, several of my friends came, had come to US, and they kept saying, you got to come here, you got to come here. And I wasn't sure. So I decided to take the plunge and came here. And I think it was the right decision in terms of coming here, because suddenly a new world opened up for me. Because I'm sure you've heard this story of a frog in a small pond versus a big pond or a big, you know, it just opened up a new world. Because first of all, I learned to be more independent, because in India, face it, when you have parents around you, you're always in a very secure environment. And here, all of a sudden, you were on your own, had to make your own decisions, find your own job, so to speak, if you want to put less burden on your parents. And then all of those things. Right? So at Wichita State, for example, to put myself through school during summers, I worked as a student janitor in the Heskett Center there, and which was okay. I learned the value of working hard. I enjoyed meeting a lot of the people who used to support the physical plant. And what was interesting about that is they were some of the most loving people that I ever met. And later, at the same institution, when I became vice president, and anytime there was anything where I was involved in, this whole bunch of physical plant employees used to show up. And our president used to wonder, why do physical plant employees come for an academic event? And then finally, I had to explain to him, they're coming to support me, Dr. Beggs. Dr. Beggs was one of my mentors. He's a retired now, amazing mentor. And I used to say, they're coming here to support me, Dr. Beggs, because they think me as their kid. And then you just meet such incredible people along the way. And the love that people provide in sometimes Midwest is misunderstood. And I have to tell you, I have found some of the most loving people, whether it's Kansas or Michigan or other areas, just wonderful people.
Agree. But Hyderabad to Kansas is a big change also, from at least 30, 40 degrees of temperature difference, but we won't go there. So the inflection point was also a decision to come to the US, but it was not a scientific. It was your friend saying, come. And you said, hey, boss, let me just give it a shot. Yes, I'll miss my mom, but you came. And then it suddenly opened up a realm of opportunities. Another inflection point that happened, because that inflection point was, it was not like you made a big strategic plan about my life, et cetera. It was just, it happened, your friend said, and you said, okay, let me go there. Other inflection point that kind of led to the next journey, what would you say, Ravi?
That would have been, frankly, my move from being a regular faculty member into the administration. And that was an interesting time as well, where what had happened was early on, in my life, I was then an associate professor with tenure. I had a lot of success, both in teaching. I had won a lot of teaching awards, thanks to people who thought I was a good teacher. And then I'd also gotten a lot of research grants. So I was considered a successful faculty member, so to speak. And at Wichita State, there was a Center for Teaching and Research Excellence. This is a faculty center where you essentially mentor other faculty members who are coming in. So the president of the university and the provost really wanted me to consider taking over the directorship of that center, because the previous director was retiring and they were recruiting me, trying to recruit me. And my first reaction was, I don't think so. I like engineering. I'm not sure if I want to do this. Doesn't seem like it fits me. So anyway, when the president and provost had called me to speak with them, as they were starting to say things, I was young. I was, frankly, wasn't interested. So even before they could complete the whole story of what they wanted me to do, I kind of started getting up saying, I'm really not interested in this. I'm sorry. President Beggs then said, Ravi, can I give you some advice? I said, yes, sir. And he said, when the president and provost take time to talk to you, the least you can do is sit down and listen. And then later, you can always say you'll sleep on it, you'll talk to your wife, and you can tell us no tomorrow. And I said, okay. So I sat down and listened. And at the end of the day, I told them, I'll think it over. I'll talk to my wife. And I made the mistake of saying, I'll talk to my advisor, because I graduated from Wichita State. I was working there. My advisor was still a faculty member. So I said, I'll talk to my advisor and I'll let you know tomorrow. They said, okay. And so next day, I am in the department and I was going over to my faculty advisor's office and he was coming to me. And he said, I was actually looking for you, Ravi. And I said, what for? And he said, I understand you have an opportunity to be the director. And he said, I think you should take it. I said, but I haven't told you what the opportunity is. He said, no, Dr. Beggs already called me and told me why it's important that you take it. And I think you should take it. So I go to Dr. Beggs' office and had this big grin on his face. And I said, wait a minute, you didn't tell me that part of what. And he said, well, that's why, son, I want you to come in administration and learn the skills. You have potential to become somebody really good. So that's why you need to come and hang out with me. And so I learned a lesson in politics and how you manage sometimes people, and ended up becoming the director of Center for Teaching and Research Excellence, along with still continuing to be a faculty member. And then later in life, when they had a opening for vice president and CIO, there was a national search. I was asked to apply and I was selected. And I, as I would say, the rest is history.
So that was another inflection point where you moved into administration from teaching.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I still continue teaching, but it really opened up a new world. I saw the world outside of engineering. I learned how amazing and creative people can be in liberal arts and in music and in arts and in history. And when you're in pure engineering, you don't see this sometimes, right? Other than some people, you may serve with them on a committee or a group or an organization. You're not exposed to it. So I always tell people, always get out of your comfort zone. Go explore areas that you don't normally do, because you'll actually learn a thing or two, which will be amazing. And I did. I learned from so many amazing teachers when I went into that role.
So going out of your comfort zone is also an important message, right, Ravi?
Yeah, absolutely. Because in an engineering, everything was set, everything was moving. And then all of a sudden, I'm now responsible to a completely new area. And I think it was a great learning experience for me.
Yeah. You touched several times on the role of some of the mentors there. A lot of our guests have talked about this, and also important, as you said, to be receptive. Is it a proactive look for you for mentors, or is it just, hey, you know, you said you keep making a note of what you learn, etc. But anybody can be a mentor, right?
Absolutely. And I work with colleagues all the time across campus, where I'm obviously a mentor to many students and still have been, and I continue to support that. But at the same time, I have many mentors, and sometimes people misunderstand mentors into somebody who may be in a different position than you, a different. Mentors can come in all sizes and shapes. This afternoon, I was talking to the president of our central student government, and she had some great ideas on some of the things we could do differently, because she's seeing from a perspective of 18 to 22-year-olds, and she had terrific advice. And so I learned from that advice, right? And so you absolutely need to be open to mentors, coaches, people like you, others. There are always people that the podcast series that different people do. I listen to those all the time. And because you're always something you're picking up somewhere, right? And I feel like people should be reserving some time from their daily schedule. We all are busy. I get that. We all have so many things to do, so many miles to run. But it's really important to stop and give some time for your own personal development in the role of learning from somebody, in the watching a podcast, talking to a friend, talking to a person, because all those things matter, actually.
So keep some time aside for self-improvement, or just keep your antennas on a receptive mode, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Self-enrichment, right? You're enriched by people around you.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Ravi, any decision that you'd like to change or take back? Any of those key inflection points or anything like that?
You know, in life, along the way, you obviously can always look back and say, maybe I could have done it this way. But what I've learned to do is accept all the things, because I am shaped by all of those decisions and all of those. So what I'm today is a result of all the right steps or the wrong steps that have been taken. I wouldn't change it, because I'm the person I'm today because of all the things that have happened along the way, right? But I wouldn't change things in any way other than to maybe take time and to express more gratitude to my parents than I did. That's one thing I always think about, because sometimes you take your parents for granted until they're gone. And so I always encourage people, if your parents are alive, tell them thank you. And I wish I could go back and tell my dad thank you, tell my mom thank you. And I did many times, but I feel like every day, you know, tell your spouse, thank you. My wife, who's been an amazing teacher to me, my son. And then it's really important. I always talk, people always ask me about what are some of the key things I think about in terms of leadership. One of them, of course, very critical to me personally is humility. The second one is being empathetic to each other. Life is too short. We need to see the best in each other and support each other. And most importantly, the gratitude. Thank you. And goes a long way in helping each other. And the power of gratitude is so important. You actually feel good when you express gratitude to other people. And so those are the things I think about. But overall, you're shaped by your life experiences, right? So I was shaped by who I am today. For example, in my spare time, something you may not know is for fun, I take nature photos on the weekends and other times. I do own photography. I capture birds in flight. I take sunrise and sunset photos. And where that reminds me, and people say, what's the fascination with sunrise and sunsets? So I always say, well, who wouldn't want sunrise and sunsets? They're beautiful. It just makes you feel good. But secondly, whenever the sun is rising, I always think in terms of that I have one more day to hopefully make some type of positive difference to somebody else, if I'm able to, if I should feel fortunate if I have that opportunity. And in the evening, as the sun is setting and moon is coming up, that's time to reflect back and give gratitude to people who made a difference to you. Because each day, somebody does something for you, just like you may be able to do something for somebody else. And so it's important to take time and say thank you to those people. So as a routine, every evening, you'll find me taking some time and sending a few emails or a text message just saying thank you to a few people. Doesn't take a lot of time investment. It just takes a few minutes of your time, but it matters to people that you write, and you actually feel good when you say thank you to people. So that's the fascination with sunrise and sunsets. And I'll tell you another fascinating story. I just feel so blown away. About a year and a half ago, I had an accident while I was out photographing. I actually ended up falling. I jokingly say I was dunking basketball over our basketball coach, but that was not true. It was just a stupid fall and ended up shattering my elbow and having multiple surgeries and so on. And it was my dominant hand, so I couldn't type or write for 6 months. So I went through some dark times. I was depressed. I struggled with it. Because when you're a personality on the go and suddenly your body says you can't actually go, it's hard. So I was very transparent about it with my staff and everybody else who was available. But the community around here was incredibly supportive. To the point, I'll tell you a story of a young woman. I have never met her again. Her name was Tessa. And I was walking on our driveway and I was wearing a special brace that time. And this blue car passed by our driveway and then stopped. And this young woman got out and she came over and she said, I noticed you are wearing an occupational therapy brace. So it looks like you have a long recovery ahead of you. So I'm an occupational therapist. So I just want to say to you that keep doing it. Don't give up because then it'll get better. And I said, well, thank you. And then she said, can I say a prayer to you? And candidly, when I was walking, I was on the phone talking to a friend who lives in Dallas, and I had to ask him to hold. And so I said, sure, if you want to pray. I said, can you say a silent prayer? She said, okay. So she said a silent prayer and drove off. And I shared this entire team. I've never seen her again. I don't know who she is. I've never seen her car in our area again because I just felt I didn't thank her enough. So if I ever see her again, I want to say thank you to her. But the point I'm making is she took the time to do this, right? What a special person she is. And I bet she's doing this to 100 other people. And if I can just send a message to a person and say thank you, that's good too. So every little thing matters if you're able to help people.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing person. There are a lot of good, wonderful people in the world today that we sometimes don't realize. Ravi, you have achieved so much already, and obviously there's so much more to go. Where do you see your journey going from here?
Really, it's more than my journey. It's about along the journey of helping others who work with me and others who are outside to setting them up for success, right? And so I'm at a point in my career where I want to continue helping my students wherever I can add value. I want to continue supporting my colleagues around wherever I can add value. And I continue to expect being in the classroom. So if I was writing my own end story, I would say I would love to, you know, even in my 70s and 80s, be in that classroom, teaching the class and learning from my students. That's what I would like to do.
Well, that's a great thing. We need more teachers and more teachers like you. Ravi, towards the end, we have some lightning round of questions with short answers. The podcast is called Indianness. And everybody that we talk to has their own definition. But what is Ravi's definition of Indianness?
Well, I mean, when I think about Indianness, it's our culture. It's our family values. It's the respect for elders that we have and then the respect for our teachers that we have. India is one of the probably only countries that celebrates Teachers Day. And then so all of these things together is when I think about what Indianness is, right? And so to me, it's all of those things. It's about humility. It's about gratitude. All of those things coming together. It's about the values that have been inculcated in you by your parents. And hopefully you pass it on to the next generation.
Yeah, that's a great point. The respect for teachers. I mean, and we do have Teachers Day. We celebrate that. That's a wonderful point. Ravi, who has been the most one influential person in your journey? One person. Not two.
It would be hard to pick one, but I'll volunteer a name, and obviously I would have named my mother and so on, but I know you like somebody outside of the family. Right?
No, it can be in your, this one you can have in your family. One person, yeah. Anybody can be in your family.
So I would say if it's one person, I would have to say my mother. If you allowed me to pick three, it would be my mother, my sister, and my wife.
Okay. Well, we'll make an exception here. Mother, sister, and wife. Women power. That's pretty cool. Ravi, is there a book or a movie that has impacted you in any way?
Obviously, I read a lot, and there are a lot of books I could mention. But early in my life, my cousins used to tease me, including Harsha, by the way. They used to call me Swami Vivekananda because I used to read a lot of Swami Vivekananda's writings. And a lot of those had tremendous advice from Bhagavad Gita in it. In terms of, you know, bhakti yoga and karma yoga and so on. So I've read a lot of that. So those books have influenced and shaped me who I am. But later in life, as I've read other books, there are just so many. Malcolm Gladwell writes a lot of amazing books. I've read many of his books as well. And I just enjoy reading. And I just read a variety of books. If you're talking, don't tell me all this. Tell me some fiction and fun you do. I enjoy reading Tom Clancy and John Grisham as well. And so all these books have something you can pick up from. And maybe that's my nerdy side where I just enjoy reading. And so I read a lot. So lots of variety of books. Early in life, it used to be actual books because my wife jokingly used to tease saying, these pencils don't know what library is. They like to buy every single book. And we have a lot of books at home. But later in life, as I travel a lot, having books on Kindle became important because of the sheer weight of the books that you have to carry on your backpack. So Kindle is much more convenient. Also, as I got older, the ability to change fonts is important because otherwise I can't see well. And so that's where the power of the Kindle or whatever book reader that people use on iPad or whatever. But so I do a lot of books on Kindle now.
Yeah. No. And unfortunately, reading is a little bit of a dying art because of the mobile and other technology. But reading, I think, is, and I'm old school. I still get a physical newspaper and you can't see right now, but on my right-hand side, there's a stack of books. I also have Kindle, but I'm a book addict. I just love reading because that's just me. But anyway.
My dad was that way too. As a story, when he passed away and I had to go home to work with my sister to figure out what to do, one of the things we had a situation was he had over 4,000 books in our home. And obviously we only took a few that we wanted to keep, but then rest of them we actually donated to one of the libraries in Hyderabad. And so there's a wing in his name in one of the libraries in Hyderabad with all the books we donated and some of the support we provide and even today. So that's what we ended up doing. So there's that book culture and the newspaper culture I can completely relate to.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Ravi, final question. Nike and others, they have their tagline. What would be Ravi Painter's tagline?
I don't consider myself important enough to have tagline.
Well, you are.
You're very kind. Thank you. But really, if I had to think of one, I would simply say, make a difference and make it happen.
Make a difference and make it happen. And also, go blue, right?
Of course, go blue is always there.
Always there. No, absolutely. But Ravi, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been just so fantastic and being so transparent and open for our listeners. So many life lessons you have taught, and what an amazing journey. So really, thank you from all of us to you.
And I appreciate that, but I do want to say thank you for the time and the opportunity. And what I'm today is a product of incredible, amazing teachers I've had along the way, from my family to my staff members now and staff members at Brown, students everywhere. I owe it to all of them. So I would be nothing without all of these people. So thank you.
Well, that's what makes you special, your humility. So thank you for being on the show. Thank you.
Appreciate it, man. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Indianist Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.